It's November 17th, 2011. This is the Hell Yeah Show. Hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show. I'm Alan.
I'm Emery.
And we are bringing you best practices for fine living. Advice on... Yeah, advice on how to not let technology ruin your day. Emery, now you can talk.
I'm so excited and I just can't hide it. It is the Storage Show, episode 15.
It is indeed. 15. Oh, wow, 15.
We can almost drive.
That's a lot of episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so this is the Storage Show. We're going to be talking about... all sorts of storage philosophies and storage practices. We're talking about digital storage, so storing files on disks. And we're going to be talking with a special guest, John Duxta, later in the show. That will be an interview with him, or not really an interview, a discussion with him that will come on later. So do stay tuned for that. But for the time being, it's just me and Emery.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk very briefly, the very talented gentleman, Clancy, who does our intro theme. He has a record coming out soon called Iowania, and the release notes have a URL that you can go to listen to more of his wonderful music. And remember, the nicest thing about Clancy is when you shake him, that beautiful music falls out.
did that come from you, or is that his like slogan?
That's all me.
That's all you. Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm very
eloquent. Description.
Yeah. Yeah.
Poetic, even.
Yeah. So the big news this week, of course.
Yes, big news.
Is SOPA, which SOPA. I like that you call the Stop Online Privacy Act.
Well, that's what it is. That's what SOPA stands for, right?
I think it was private, or I think maybe it was piracy.
No, I did. I wrote this incorrectly.
I thought that was on purpose.
I mistyped. I'm actually going to keep it. I'm gonna do a parenthetical here in the show notes so you can see what I did here. It's the Stop Online Piracy Act. I wrote in the show notes that it was the Stop Online Privacy Act, which isn't that far off, right?
No, this is ridiculous. This is probably like one of the Protecting Children Online bill that was proposed. Mm-hmm. This is just another. I mean, I get really worked up about media companies getting this involved in the internet, because it's a technology that they just don't really understand, and they've got a ton of lobbyists and they really manipulate. And I mean,
well, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act
that was just the start. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it is a good example of a law that was influenced heavily by the entertainment industry and media companies. And as a result, did not display possibly the breadth of knowledge of the technical underpinnings that one might expect from a law that would have such wide-reaching effects.
Yes, yes.
And so this looks to be another one of those things, although potentially worse.
Yeah, well, there's an awful lot of potential ramifications and fallout from this bill. I mean, right now, there's an awful lot that happens on the internet every day that is amazing. And there are occasionally things like software piracy or copyright infringement or distribution of copyrighted materials. Clearly not an appropriate use. I'm not advocating in favor of copyright violations. What I have a huge problem with, though, is letting media companies dictate what can and cannot be said or written or published on the internet. And what this bill is talking about is letting people effectively squelch and disable access to any website that, you know, it could be something as simple as the example of the baby dancing in a video on YouTube, and there's a song playing in the background, and the copyright holder says, you know, you have to take this down because you're playing one of the songs that we own and publish in the background. And it's not even like... You know, the video is clearly not about the song, but...
Yep, and it's not going to infringe upon sales of the song or any of that stuff.
No, and they're not claiming it as their own, you know?
Right, yep.
Like, their work, their creative work is the baby dancing, but, you know, someone somewhere is hell-bent on making sure that all the fun is sucked out of the internet. so, you know, this is the internet is for serious business, so, you know, we can't have people humming pop songs or babies dancing or clips from, you know, like the whole concept of fair use even is at stake here.
Yeah, well, and so the sort of the other side of this is the actual technical restrictions that it imposes, or the ways in which it goes about implementing its attempts to curb those illegitimate uses that do exist and that are unfortunate, are extreme to the point of messing with the domain name service, so DNS, which underpins the internet, which makes the internet possible.
They've already – see, here's the most frustrating and asinine part of this legislation is that everything they're talking about, they already have a way to do. So the if someone has infringing material online, you can send them a takedown notice, and the person that you know, the publisher is legally obligated to take it down, which is what happens right now.
The issue, I guess, is you have a publisher who is not in the United States and does not have their servers in the United States, and as a result cannot be, or you know, is in some country where they cannot be legally affected by such a takedown notice or sued or any of that type of stuff.
Well, they could be sued. It just involves them suing them in another country.
And right.
So
right.
Instead of actually filing a lawsuit and doing things the right way, what they're going to do is they just want to be able to intervene and have someone disable the DNS name for any of these sites. And this has already happened too, right? Because the copyright or the there's a Counterfeit Goods Act to let people, because the DHS seized a bunch of domain names earlier this year.
The other part of this, though, is it actually forces internet service providers to basically censor the websites that their customers can access through the domain name service.
It monkeys with safe harbor. So right now what happens is that if you are a service provider or a content provider and one of your users does something stupid, you are protected through what's called safe harbor. So you could say... if you're Facebook and someone posts a copy of a movie online, then when someone says, "That's my movie, take that down," you know, Facebook's like, okay, we'll do that. And then they take it down. But now they're potentially going to be liable for all the content on their network, which means that they have to censor the content. So you're asking people to put resources and staff and spend a lot of money on implementing censorship, which goes against like the entire premise of the internet. I mean, there was an interview with Vint Cerf, he's kind of a big deal. Like he's one of two people that invented the internet.
Yes, he works for Google now, I believe.
I met him at a grocery store in Fairfax, Virginia.
Oh, that's great! Wow,
yeah, it's kind of a funny story. I said it was during World Cup, and he and I think it must have been his wife were talking about soccer, and I felt like a total schmuck because I didn't want to like interrupt them or anything, right? But like there was a lull in conversation while I was like, you know, pretending to look at an apple, and I was like, "Hey, I'm sorry for interrupting, but I just wanted to say thanks for that internet thing." and he chuckled. He says, "You're welcome."
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, this was, I think, when he was working at UUNet. But I mean, he has. There was an article. We have it in the Evernote. I should probably kick that into the show notes. But he recently was asked a lot of things about the internet, and as somewhat of an expert, and he gave his opinion, and he was very strongly of the opinion that overreaching enforcement and really aggressive censorship was not the correct position to take for something like this. I mean
it goes against the structure and the principles of the internet currently exists.
And the DNS system, which lets you type in a name in your browser and get to someone's website, that system is up for being monkeyed with. And this actually could potentially take that system away from the United States. Because right now, the company that's ultimately responsible for the majority of that traffic is a United States company. And if there was ever leverage to pull that infrastructure away and that service away from us, it's something like this. Because it's supposed to be an open system. There's already a system in place for revoking. You know, I don't understand. Do we really want to be a country like Egypt or a country like Iran that, or Saudi Arabia, where there's like state controlled proxies that you have to use to access the internet because, you know, someone in Washington had a lobbyist whisper in their ear that, you know, there's people looking at movies on YouTube that they didn't pay for or something. Like, it blows my mind that people are so willing to give up their ability to look at content online to their government. It makes no sense to me. And especially when the government even doesn't want to do it, it's really media companies.
Well, like, so and here on the lobbying point, as well as the media company point, here's my question here. I mean, at this point, and there's this great video that we're going to link to in the show notes that you can watch online. Made by internet hero Turtle JP.
Yeah. Our internet hero.
Yes, yes. And it details the various arguments against this, as well as kind of an overview of what is up with this act. And I think it's actually talking about the Senate equivalent of SOPA, which is Protect IP.
Yeah.
And one of the points it brings up is the entertainment industry compared to the internet industry is actually not that big.
No.
Because the internet industry is pretty large.
Yes.
And my question is, I mean, at this point, internet companies have to have more lobbying capacity than entertainment companies do.
Well, what's really dumb, though, seriously, is that they're expending all this effort. They are completely wasting your time and your money even discussing this, because the things that they can do to actually implement these changes are trivial to circumvent.
Oh, that's like, the other thing. Yeah, you can just type in an IP address and
or use a different DNS server.
Right.
You know, like there's a million things you can do that get around this without them.
Because again, the laws are being made without good technical understanding of.
Yeah, they don't know what's going on. They have no idea
of the structures that are in place. Yeah.
This is also a fight against network neutrality, because now by keeping the internet neutral to content, it lets them charge the same for megabytes going to, you know, Tumblr as it does to YouTube, as it does to Netflix, right? Mm-hmm. And the carriers are all complaining about this sometimes, because they're like, well, you know, it costs us more money to move the packets from A to B. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's your business. Like, that's what you do. That's the whole point. Like, there's ways to optimize and do that differently, but are you really like going to be charging people? It doesn't make any sense, because it's not like they're destitute and can't improve their own infrastructure. They just choose not to. So I don't know. I don't buy the arguments for it. And I think that something like this lets them kind of do an end run around being a service provider and let them kind of dictate what you're able to see.
Right. Yeah. As opposed to just giving you the pipe.
Yes. Are they a utility, or are they an arm of the government?
Yeah, exactly. Are they dictating the content that is flowing through that pipe, or managing it somehow? If so, then that's a real problem. Because that does go against a lot of, as we said, the structure and the principles of the internet.
And they don't define any of this either. They're like, you know, oh, like cyber lockers and parasites and rogue sites. Like they use all this like really weird, vague terminology that was like invented specifically for this purpose. And it's specifically created to create a false sense of urgency and like lead you to believe this is like just critical. Like, you would not believe the billions of dollars that are being lost every day because... Right. Someone is humming a song on YouTube.
Well, they set out these intentionally, in some cases, broad definitions.
Yeah.
You know, like a rogue website, you know, which are intended to leave a lot of flexibility for what you actually define a rogue website as.
Exactly.
Which is very advantageous to the media companies, because you know, then there is a greater chance that whatever website they are trying to take down specifically fits into the definition of a rogue website.
If I'm doing a video chat with somebody and I've got music playing in the background, technically I'm broadcasting a copy of music, right? Like, so under this bill, you could make a case that I would be guilty of a crime that's punishable by 5 years in jail.
Oh, that is the other part of this, is there are significantly raised punishments for this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and also still very loose descriptions of what this is, and you know, the real problem from my understanding, is that there's like, you know, idiots that stream TV shows on Ustream. So they go after this by saying, if you put any video on the internet that's not, you know, blah, 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 like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, it doesn't actually solve the problem. Because what they could do is they could send a letter to Ustream, right? Because they can already do this. And they can say, tell us this user's information. And then they can go after the internet provider. And they can get a subpoena and identify them and sue them. Yep. They already have a legal remedy to fight. But instead, they're just saying, well, that's a lot of work, you know, to go do things the right way and go talk to judges and get subpoenas. Couldn't we just, like, I don't know.
Just block it.
Yeah, just turn it off. Like, just trust us. We've looked at this. We know it's not supposed to be there. And I know the internet's hard. We got it all figured out. Remember, this is the same industry that can't figure out how to, like, distribute media. Like, the internet is a technology that these companies do not understand and that they do not embrace and that they resist at every single turn, and you're going to hand the keys over to them.
Yeah. So overall, SOPA not particularly favored here at the Hellgas show. And not getting a lot of love around the internet either. You can find a myriad of various editorial pieces, as well as protests or websites giving you information about how to fight this bill all over the place, as well as this wonderful video that we're going to link to
this,
in the show.
This capability, if they get it, even if you don't care about like copyright enforcement issues or things like that, just remember the next time you go to, like, you know, the Drudge Report, if there's a story there that could be construed as either infringing in some way or harmful to people. Something like that. Like, they could just shut down a news site because they don't like the content there. Like, if someone doesn't like someone republishing or reposting an article on a news site, and since they would then have the technical capability to do it for just about anything, you know, maybe they don't think that you should have the right to look at anything that's related to any.
It crosses a dangerous line.
Yeah, it enables them to say, oh, well, you guys were okay with us, like, you know, throwing people in jail for YouTubing, so you'll be fine with someone called someone a bad name, and we're just going to disable that site now, so you can't go there anymore.
Anyway, do check out the video in the show notes, because it explains the issue better than we can, and definitely keep an eye on SOPA. And write your letters as necessary. It would be very nice to see this not happen.
Write letters and call.
Yes. Okay. So now, as promised at the beginning of the show, we have our spectacular guest segment featuring John Duxta. And we are going to transition to that right now. All right. And we are joined now by John Duxta, who is here to talk about storage. Talk us through home storage, business storage in all forms, more terabytes, more problems. John is a security engineer and a general purpose geek, as well as a hobbyist hardware hacker. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you, Alan. Good to be here.
All right. Before we get into storage, we've got some very exciting stuff that happened this past week, or a very exciting thing, which is the release of the Kindle Fire. And John, I believe you have one, don't you?
I do. I have it in my hands. Got it yesterday. Delivered to the office and showed up around noon. So this is essentially my first 36 hours with the Kindle Fire.
All right. And how is it working out for you?
It's working pretty well. It is. So it's exactly what I expected it to be, which is, so far it's a media consumption device. That's what it was meant to be. The tech pundits have been, you know, saying, oh, this is a, you know, is it going to be an iPod killer? What's it going to be? iPad killer. No, it's not. It's, I don't think it's meant to be.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a Kindle before the Fire?
I did not have a Kindle before the Fire. I do have a Sony PRS505 that I've had for a few years, and, which I'm absolutely love. It's not going away. This is not going to replace it. It suits a different niche for me. Like the e-ink reader is great for text. absolutely mm-hmm. fantastic for text. And I will continue to use it for just straight up book reading. But the Fire for me, is, first off, you know, I mean, it's meant to consume Amazon, you know, it's built to consume Amazon media content, digital mm-hmm. content. So, so I have, the video streaming on it. Absolutely fantastic. First thing I streamed on it was the,
Hell Yeah Show.
Actually,
after the Hell Yeah Show, what was the second thing?
After the Hell Yeah Show, the first thing I streamed on it was Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Oh nice. Man.
And brilliant. Looks awesome. Then of course I had to hit up a little Arrested Development. So
fantastic. Some good choices. Good.
Yeah. So, so that's great. I've also been reading some comic books on it, which, like, that was the other use case for this for me is, you know, because you can't really read comic books on an e-ink reader. Just doesn't work well.
Sure.
But, especially in color. But these, like, it looks fantastic. I laid in bed last night and read, like, 10 comic books. It was awesome.
Now, do you think that the glossy display, I mean, I know it was made more for, like, video or rich media. Do you think it's going to make it more difficult to read on? Like, is this, have you tested the, like, a Kindle book or something on the Fire?
To be honest, I have not. So,
okay.
I mean, you know, it comes with, like, the Oxford American Dictionary. And, I probably wouldn't like read a full on like book with this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Although I just pulled up just the dictionary cause you know, I really like reading the dictionary. It really enriches me. So, when you do pull up a book, it seems that it dims it out. Like the page, quote unquote, it's not pure white. It's dimmed down. It's got some gray in the background, so it's not like it's not a harsh contrast. Like really,
it's not going to burn it into your eyes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I mean, I could read a book on this. But you know, given the choice between reading straight up text on an e-reader, on an e-ink reader, and reading on this, I'll take the e-ink reader because that's just so much easier on the eyes. I don't like reading volumes and volumes of text on an LCD display.
Yeah, so. Definitely. So, how's the form factor working out for you? I guess the 7-inch display. How's that like carrying it? I don't know if you've carried it out for a day yet, but
it's mostly been. So this was combined with the fact that like I didn't really have a lot of time to play with it last night because half my evening was taken up by a team dinner kind of thing that we went out for last night. So I haven't been carrying it around so much, although I did yesterday afternoon as I was leaving the office, I realized, well, damn, I don't want to throw this. I don't have a case for it yet.
Okay.
So, and I didn't want to just throw it in my bag like naked. So I went to the,
point of order real quick. What bag are you using these days?
I'm actually using the company issued backpack. It works well for me. Like the so I still have my Chrome bag, and I love my Chrome bag, but it does mess with my back a bit. And I have my walk to work is a mile, and so it this bag is actually pretty good. It's got nice pockets. It's well organized. I know you'll frown on it, but Mr. Bag Snob. But no, it's a decent bag.
That's good.
So
but you didn't want to like just chuck it in there. So it's not
I didn't want to just chuck it in there because I do have some other things in there that might scratch it. So I went to the supply room, to the copy room, and raided and grabbed I made a totally ghetto sleeve for it.
That's what I'm talking about. The same thing. Yeah. My MacBook Air. I went down to CVS the day I got it, and I got like one of those bubble wrap envelopes.
That's exactly what I've got. Bubble wrap envelope.
Yes.
I
took it to the paper cutter. I eyeballed the width, cut it, and I'm like, okay, it's a little loose on the top. Taped down the edge a bit.
Yeah.
So it fits. And like for just trucking it back and forth in my bag, it's a great little sleeve.
Wow.
Oh, that's great. And then also, it also doubles as a pre-made label to return it if you ever lose it.
Yeah, when I first got my iPad, actually, I did not even think of that. I was, and the cases were all sold out, so I ended up wrapping it in like a gym shirt, which which sounds so inelegant compared to what is such a simple solution of those bubble manila envelopes.
Yeah. I wrapped my iPhone 4 in a jock strap.
Oh, yeah? Yeah?
Yeah.
That's good. That's secure. Yeah, very secure.
Right on my arm. It's not going anywhere.
Nice. All right. But overall, you're digging the Kindle Fire so far?
I am digging it. Yeah. It's a nice device. It's what I expected. And, you know, and I have no complaints about it. And for $200, like, it's, you know, it almost becomes... It's getting into geek impulse buy price point.
That's a dangerous price point. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a specific price point for people, you know, that work in technology, right? Like there's a certain, there's a price that we're $200 for us is a very different $200 for a lot of other people. So I am curious to see how well that will translate to other users, but it sounds like the experience from like everything that I've been reading online, the impressions that I've seen from people with the Amazon Prime Video, people are just loving it, and I think that it can fill a pretty big gap for a lot of people. So I'm really curious to see how well it works out.
Yeah,
it's certainly a better price point than an iPad if you were only going to be using it as a as an e-reader and video device, right?
Yeah, I mean I can't justify $500-$600 for an iPad. I mean I already have. I have a MacBook Pro. I've got an iMac up in the office here. I've you know, but for just something to carry around and consume stream, you know, media on, this fits that niche really well.
Yeah, so. It's a good form factor too. I think like I was kind of apprehensive seeing that it was going to be that size, but I don't know. Like the more I've been looking at it.
Yeah, you know, I could use something in between my iPad and my iPhone. Now that you mention it, that impulse is starting to grow a bit. Yeah,
I think it's ideal for commuters too. It's something easy to use one handed, and while the iPad is too, it's definitely because of the size, it's easier to use for some things, but others, I don't know. It's definitely interesting. I hate that it's this good. To be honest, because I don't want to be the guy that has the iPad and the Kindle and the phone and the laptop.
Yep. And can only take one of them out at a time.
Yeah. Well, I'm already that asshole on the bus, though. Like, you know, if I'm reading my messages on my phone and then I'm like, okay, I'm bored.
Well, you should have one device for each of your bags, and then you just you choose the bag that you want to take, and that determines which devices you have.
That is not a terrible idea.
I know. Yeah, just a bunch of like pre-built bags or pre-stuffed bags. Yeah.
Kind of liking that.
So one of the things that is a little weird about it is the way you're supposed to hold it has the speakers on the top and the power button, USB port, and the headphone jack on the bottom. Mm-hmm. But one of my colleagues who also picked one up and just got it yesterday was mentioning, and I found I did this a couple times too, holding, depending on how you hold it, like if you hold it along the bottom, you might have a tendency to accidentally turn it off. Because you'll hit the power button, which is on the bottom edge. But if you just turn it upside down, the accelerometer will be like, oh, you're holding it upside down. Let me turn that around for you. And that basically fixes that.
Is it more of a sleep, or is it actually like shutting it down?
No, it's a sleep.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So no, like when you hit the power button, it just puts it to sleep, and then you hit it again and swipe across the screen and it wakes it back up. So
that's slick.
All right. Cool. So, all right. Well, good to know that that the Kindle Fire has delivered on its promise of at least being a rather interesting device and something that I am starting to consider purchasing.
I was thinking the other day too, because I was like, there's going to be people that like get a Nook at Christmas, and those people are going to be kind of like the kids that got a ColecoVision. We're going to be like, oh wow, you got a Nook. That's great. Thanks.
Well, you could probably sideload the Kindle store onto it.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, very good. But John, we did not take you on the show just to talk about the Kindle Fire. We brought you on to talk about storage.
Yes.
So Emery, you want to kind of introduce this topic a bit before we get started?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think, especially in my immediate family, when talking to people, is that the general paradigm in computing has changed quite a bit for a lot of households in particular. There's more devices using more services inside and outside the home. You have more computers. I mean, it used to be that you had like one system, single user, and you know, one person at a time used the computer, right? And now more and more commonly having not only smartphones or devices like Kindles and iPads, but you also have laptops and connected PCs, home media center PCs, game consoles that can, you know, play back music and video from over the network. You got Blu-ray players that can do the same, plus use services like Netflix or Amazon Prime. So there's been a lot of shifting there, and I think some people aren't really sure how they should be handling all of their bits and bytes on their home network. Do you want to have them all in one place? Do you want to have like a network service? Is it too silly or stupid to have a network file server in your house? There's a lot of questions there. And I think that hopefully we can tackle some of that tonight. I mean, we've gone from floppies to fixed hard disks. We've got removable drives. You know, backup systems have changed over the years. We've also got all these optical media floating around. So how can we best serve our most important users, who are the people in our household?
Okay, very good. So I thought maybe before we get started here, we want to go around the table and sort of get everyone's storage philosophy or how you manage your own storage around your house. So Emery, you want to start us off with your philosophy?
Yeah. I like to have everything on one central repository that everyone that needs to reach it can reach. So I have, we have a ready NAS in the house that I've had for years and years. It's definitely an older model. It has a somewhat old CPU in it, but it has 4 terabytes of storage. And since I don't like to have like DVDs floating around, we sometimes have movies that we own, we've encoded so that we can play them back in the living room without having to like juggle discs and all that. So
yeah.
I do have big plastic bins full of DVDs that I get to put somewhere else, so they're not you know, cluttering up the joint. I also like to have really important documents and files available on really redundant storage. I'm a big believer in, I like a file system called ZFS. I use ZFS for my workstations. And the reason for that is that it's very easy to take snapshots and roll back any changes or destructive things that I might do. I also trust ZFS a lot more than other desktop file systems. I mean, Windows machines, the native file system is NTFS. Mac users have HFS and HFS Plus. ZFS is not well supported on Mac OS 10 yet, but there is a vendor working on changing that. And there's a product from a company called Tens Complement that has really a lot of promise. So I guess my general philosophy is lots of redundancy, especially for critical media. I don't really know how else I would explain it. I mean,
cool. Yeah. All right. John, you want to take us through your philosophy and storage practices?
Sure. So my story is very, very similar to Emery's. We have a so we're a household of two people with 4 computers in the house. So one of them is you know, an iMac running OS X server up here in the office with the Drobo attached.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So this is a second gen standalone, a second gen attached Drobo. So it's FireWire 800 attached to the iMac. It's not a NAS like Emery has, but it's attached to my iMac, shows up as a volume. I have and this is where the bulk of what lives on the Drobo is all of our media. So, like Emery, we've ripped most of our DVDs. Unlike Emery, we threw away all the cases, and and put them in, put all the DVDs in those folders, the zip cases.
Yep.
So,
yep.
And those live on a shelf at the bottom of the bookshelf here. Also other things that end up on the Drobo are backups, both.
You use Time Machine?
No, we don't use Time Machine, because, all of the, so everything that's on the server is backed up to the cloud, using Backblaze. Yeah. So, but the backups directory on the Drobo is actually for stuff that's out on our like hosted server, the server that Emery and I. So all of my sites and stuff that are on the server that we share I have a backup script that runs there, creates a tarball. It backs up the databases and for the MySQL databases for the sites that I need that I run, dumps them, and then I have an rsync job that runs every night and grabs a backup back to this machine here, and then that stuff then gets backed up to Backblaze as it happens.
And that is the sort of you want multiple copies in multiple geographical locations, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
I do have a duplicity job that runs. And Duplicity is an open source application for doing network backups. I have the documents folders for my wife and I on the NAS get backed up to Amazon S3 every night.
Nice.
But I don't have my media being backed up offsite. Like I have my iTunes library gets backed up to a removable USB drive that I can take with me somewhere. So if the house is on fire. And I need to grab one thing on my way out the door, it's going to be the USB drive that's on top of the computer in my office, because that has our media and a recent backup of all of our critical stuff. The NAS can go up in flames because I can re-rip. It would suck. I'm not telling you it's not going to suck, but I can re-rip my movies, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of this stuff I can't. So that's definitely something I take with me.
Yeah, no. Backblaze, I would say so a lot. I can reset my settings on Backblaze to back up all my media, but the stuff I really care about, which is our documents, the backups from the server, and the music, because we have something in the order of 60 or 70 gig of music.
Wow.
That if that were to go up in flames at some point, I would be really, really sad.
Yep.
But going back to the storage option, the storage question. So I've had Drobo for, Emery got his ReadyNAS, and he liked it, but he was a little sad about it because there were some things he didn't like about it. And I was like, well, you know what? I'm going to get a Drobo. So,
I've heard good things about Drobo.
So I'm really happy with Drobo for the most part. One of the big complaints that you will hear about Drobo is that it is kind of slow. I would recommend Ars Technica wrote a really, really great two-part article on Drobo and how it works about a year, year and a half ago. If you want to really dork out on something, that is a great read on storage and how Drobo works under the hood. The ReadyNAS and other home RAID boxes are doing RAID 5, RAID 5 plus 1, etc. The Drobo works. That one of the things about the Drobo is you can mix and match drive sizes, and it does that because it is aware. It's not block level redundancy. It's basically it understands the file system. It understands what's a file in the file system. Hmm. So it's really there's an extra layer of abstraction because the way Drobo works, it's under the hood. What's really on the disk is a Linux file system with with a, you know, when with whatever file system you format it on top of it. So there's an abstraction layer there. So
yeah, the ReadyNAS has something similar. They have technology they call RAIDX, and what it is essentially, you can pull one drive out while it's running and replace it with a larger one if you wanted to, and kind of scale your storage up. And the Drobo offers similar functionality, which is great for flexibility, and especially now. The flooding in Thailand has really destroyed hard drive prices. Like, the supply is completely out of control right now. So if you see a 1 or 2 terabyte drive for $100 or less, buy it, because you're not going to see a cheaper one for like 12 months.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Like, it is out of control. Like, if you go, I was trying to find one on Amazon the other day, and like everything's like $200 plus. Like, the prices have almost doubled in less than 2 months.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's important. It's important to choose something that you can grow gracefully with, especially when in these troubled times.
On a quick aside, there, do you know if that affects like large server farms as well? The hard drive, the current hard drive shortage.
Well, keep in mind also that there's two different models of hard drive, right? Like, there's the consumer model, which is not designed necessarily to run 24/7 for years and years. And then there's the enterprise storage, the SAS drives and things like that, like in data centers. It will affect them as they need to get replaced. But it's going to be something that I think it'll hit the vendors first, because as things go up for RMA, like if a disk fails and it's still under warranty, you know, you send it into the manufacturer and you get it replaced, right? So,
oh, wow, yeah.
I think they're the people that are going to be immediately on the hook for it. People that, you know, have large SAN storage networks for, like, you know, enterprise networks or research institutions, things like that, they're not going to feel the hit for quite a while, I don't think, if they do at all.
Okay.
The I was actually reading an article by Cringely the other day, and they were saying that he was saying that the biggest market that's really going to get hit by this is it's the 3.5-inch disk market. Yeah. It sounded like, from what he was saying, that the 2.5-inch disk market is not, you know, it's really not as impacted, because not as much of those are made in Thailand. So, okay.
And that's in the 2.5-inch disks, that includes laptop drives and the SAS drives and SSDs, right?
Yeah, but I mean, he's talking about 2.5-inch. You know, moving media disks, not flash.
Sure. So, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
So,
right, wait. So back to your setup or your philosophy, John. Any other pieces that that we haven't talked about yet?
I mean, you know, it's you know.
Now, real quick though, you said, since you have the Drobo attached to the iMac and it's running OS X server and it's exporting file systems to your network, do you then mount your file system from that and use it live when you're in the house, or do you have things that like push and synchronize? Like I like to use software called Unison to keep my documents folder on my MacBook Air in sync with the documents folder on my NAS.
So
do you do something like that? Or
yeah, so I was using mobile home directories for a long time, but I have a lot of stuff in my home directory.
Yeah,
and I have a really weird setup where, like, my iTunes music directory is not in the normal location sitting in my home directory. It's,
yep,
you know, it's off on the Drobo mount. And so things get weird.
Sure.
It gets really weird when I try to do mobile home directory. So I kind of gave up on that about a year ago. And I more or less treat my laptop as we treat our laptops as you know, just kind of, you know, sorry.
Scratch space.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. I've used source code revision control systems before for things like my documents folder. I've had a lot of good luck with using things like Subversion and Git. It's super nerdy though. It's not really something that a lot of people.
And it's not great for large files, right? If you've got media files in there.
No. Well, it can be okay for that as long as they don't change.
Right, right.
It's big files that change where you start to really hit the wall fast with something like a version control system.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, and anything that's like anything that's a binary file format, doing that, using a version control system for that is just, you know, anytime you make a change, it's really just a complete change to the file.
Right,
so, yeah.
Right.
They're not super good at making determinations like, you know, differential changes.
Yeah. So, but you know, it's, yeah, the laptops are scratch devices, and you know, if there's anything we really care about, you know, just kind of on the hook to kind of toss it up on the server and leave it there. But, everything on the server gets backed up to, like I said, gets backed up to Backblaze, and, you know, God knows how much disk I'm using with those guys, but
how strong of a recommendation? I don't know a whole lot about Backblaze. Do you like them?
I like them. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've only had, you know, and it's an insurance policy. I pay $50 a year. I've only had to recover a couple of small files a couple of times. Their software just, you know, first off, they actually have OS X software, which a lot of, you know, a lot of the, online backup companies don't. And, it's, you know, it's a pretty decent, you know, it's a pretty decent deal. It's $50 a month for unlimited storage. So
now for tinfoil hat wearers like us, do they let you manage your own encryption key so that
they do.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh,
wow. And what that means is that it means that when you back up stuff to Backblaze, you can assign a encryption key to protect the data that only you know. So that, if there's a compromise at Backblaze or a rogue employee, they would not be able to access your data without compromising that key somehow. So that's one of the criticisms for services like Dropbox, for example, where you can't control the encryption key. Backblaze, that's definitely a differentiation point for them from other vendors.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's you know, it's definitely a plus. They're really, really transparent about how they run their business too. I discovered them a few years ago when a friend of ours
put their hardware make their disk arrays.
Yes. Yeah.
Everything they do, like you can actually look at how Backblaze makes their network storage array.
Yeah.
And they make them cheap too. It's like, I can't remember what the price is, but they're like, they have an article called Petabytes for Pennies or something.
Yeah.
No, like, where they actually show you how to make a really amazing storage system.
Yeah. And you know, and they just have racks and racks and racks of that. So
yeah.
I think that's, you know, they're just dealing with like massive economies of scale and being able to just throw, you know, lots of cheap hardware at storing your data for you. So.
Well, nice.
What's your philosophy, Alan?
Mine is going to sound pathetic next to both of yours.
What do you have, Alan? Do you have a USB flash drive you carry around in your pocket?
Yes, yeah, so I've got this 2 gigabyte flash drive.
I have my C drive and my text files and my batch files.
Yep. I've got all my documents are synced through Dropbox. I've got basically my documents folder, but I've got a few specific folders in there that are documents that I work on often and that are very important. And so those two subsets of the documents are synced through Dropbox, which is great because then I can access them from iPhone or from another laptop or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have a Western Digital 500 gigabyte USB drive that I back up my computer hard drive to. Yeah. that is not network attached in the slightest. Every couple of weeks or so, I will do a full backup of my laptop hard drive to that. And that's mostly just any large media files and stuff that aren't caught by the Dropbox sync. We'd go to that.
One interesting thing to remember, too, is that a lot of times it kind of makes a decision you have to kind of figure out how fast you want to be able to access something, right? So like an internal hard drive is probably one of the fastest things you can have. And then kind of branching out from there, you've got Thunderbolt, you have USB and FireWire and things like that and eSATA. And then you have like storage in the cloud. One nice thing about Dropbox, though, is that it syncs everything. So you have it all local already.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with something like S3, you'd have to like pull it remotely. So there is kind of like that decision that you need to make, like how readily available do I need my data? Have you found that like having the portable USB drive, I mean, there's a lot of convenience there, but there's also kind of a performance hit.
Yeah, I mean, really, all it really does is give me some additional peace of mind. It's kind of like, I used to use that for all of my backup. Like that was, that, and actually I've got another similar hard drive in San Diego that I back up to when I go to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
So to try and get some geographical redundancy there, although I'm only in San Diego a couple times a year. But So I used to be, this used to be my primary backup before I used Dropbox for all my current documents and stuff like that. And so it's kind of just a holdover from that, and it's just something I have around, so I feel like I might as well use it to provide me with that little bit of extra peace of mind. But as far as sort of convenience of pulling things back off of it or that sort of stuff, or convenience of being able to sync with it, like it's not it's always here near my desk, but it's not like I'm going to it that often. So anyway, but then I've got that. I've got on my desktop, that's got two internal 1 terabyte drives that are in a RAID 1 configuration. But
are you doing like a BIOS, like in the BIOS for your controller? You're doing a RAID there? Okay.
Yes, it is a RAID through, sorry, through the ASUS BIOS. I'm still sick, as you can probably tell.
I think we all are.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, it's a RAID 1 through the ASUS BIOS, and it is, and it works well. I have not had issues with it yet, so for the time being, I'm happy there.
Yeah.
And other than that, I tried a Mozy for a bit. I tried, what was it, Crash Plan for a bit.
I like Spider Oak.
Did not try, what's that?
Spider Oak, I like them.
Huh, did not try them. And I just ended up realizing the documents that are, or all of the files that are crucially important to me can fit within 2 gigabytes. And Dropbox gives me 2 gigabytes for free. So I just started doing all that stuff through Dropbox. Anyway, that is my pathetic storage story.
It's okay, because you're still a poor college student, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's still house, not even household, still dorm room of one. So it's not like I'm managing large quantities of media.
Yeah, they're all living hand to mouth out there at Stanford.
Yep. Living on the free handouts of the Dropbox 2 gigabytes. So
that's okay. You know, they have like an educational discount there, right?
I didn't know that, actually.
I'm pretty sure that that they do. And then there's some of the universities are even talking to other storage providers and seeing if there's a way they can kind of implement something like that to let people share information in between institutions too. So there's some possibility there that someone in that space is going to start landing some pretty big conversations there.
Wow.
Because I know a bunch of the CIOs have been talking to a couple of the vendors, and there's been some talk there, and I think it'll be really interesting to see how cloud storage matures. My biggest complaint with things like this, I'm sure this will really surprise you, I've got a complaint, but there's something to be said for, I like the idea of cloud storage, but what I don't like is that I have it everywhere. And I think if I could just, for example, if there was a way that I could just buy 10 gigs of storage from somebody and then use that 10 gigs of storage with other services like Flickr or Google Apps or things like that, like if I could just have one repository that I could kind of like farm out to applications I want to use, that would be awesome. But there really isn't anything like that.
And that is a pretty difficult challenge. I mean, Flickr is not going to take kindly to hosting some of their files on some other server they can't control and that sort of stuff.
Oh, so. Well, yeah, but really what's missing is that there's a missing storage abstraction layer, to use that terminology again, where if there was a way for an application either local on your computer or on the web to talk to a file system in a way that was kind of agnostic as to like where it actually was, like you could even be using it from storage that you have in your home, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So you just subscribe once, and then everything plugs into that. Yeah,
that'd be great. I think.
I think that does exist. I think it's called S3.
Yeah. Well, that's very good point.
You do know that there is a Fuse plugin for S3, right?
There is. Yeah.
Yeah, there is.
I've seen that, and I also use Transmit on the Mac, which actually has a really clean implementation of S3 as a local file system, which is great.
You can actually mount it as a drive, right?
Yep, and that's what John's talking about too. There's a Fuse is a file system in user space for Unix neckbeards like us. there's also other plugins that you can use with Fuse, like SSHFS, which lets you take any SSH Unix account that you have somewhere and mount that as a file system also.
Hmm. Wow.
So there's some really cool stuff you can do with Fuse.
There's a Fuse plugin for Gmail, so you can use your Gmail storage as a file system.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. That's, I think I remember hearing about that when Gmail first came out, because it was like, wow, 2 gigabytes of storage? That's amazing.
Yeah, and then you can also browse it with IMAP.
Yeah. All right. Well, so let's see. Do you have any sort of overarching thoughts about storage in general? Maybe where it's going next, John?
You know, I mean, I think so. One of the things I keep hearing is that, you know, the days of the 3.5-inch drive are numbered because of power issues.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 3.5-inch drives chew a lot of power. They make a lot of heat. And so, but you know, if you look at a lot of the blade servers, you know, you'll see that most of them all have 2.5-inch drives on them, you know,
yeah, they're all 2.5-inch SAS.
Yep. So, I think we might be seeing the death of the 2.5-inch drive, the 3.5-inch drive in 5 years, 10 years. I don't know. It depends on how long all those, you know, what the turnover time for all of those chassis that accept 3.5-inch drives, especially in the enterprise space. So and you know, and with you know, with cloud you know, with cloud computing, you know, being the wave of the future, you know, a lot of companies don't know or care you know, what form their storage takes. It's just this sort of nebulous blob, you know, out on the internets.
Now, right? we talked about Drobo and the ReadyNAS, but there's other vendors also that make enterprise and home network attached storage. And one of them in particular, I know Synology has a model that uses 2.5-inch drives.
Yeah. And you know, after you mentioned that, I think was that on like show 3 or show 4, mm-hmm. I checked it out and, I kind of have a Jones to swap out the Drobo for that.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, like I've already got an investment in the Drobo and I, you know, and I'll run it until it absolutely dies.
I'm thinking I took my old desktop was a shuttle, quad core, core 2. And I've been thinking that I might just get like a JBOD, when, Z for 10 is done and just do a ZFS pool off that. Mm-hmm. And a JBOD is like it's literally just a box of disks. So you have like a big enclosure and then you can just slam a bunch of disks into it and do your own RAID.
What does the J stand for?
Just.
Oh, just. Oh, got it. Yeah. Okay. I see.
So RAID stands for a redundant array of inexpensive drives. And JBOD is just a box of disks.
Wow, so, man, they are. This is like RSS, really simple syndication.
Yeah, Well, there's a lot of
casual acronyms
or recursive acronyms like Pine. Back in the day, the email client Pine was Pine is not Elm, because Elm was another mail reader.
That's great.
Yeah,
wow, you're really showing your neck beard tonight, Emery.
Oh yeah, well it's luxurious right now for November. But yeah, so I've been looking at the Synology stuff and I like it a lot, because my concern is that eventually my ReadyNAS is going to die. I've had it forever and it's starting to hold me back in a couple of places for things like automating backups and things, because it takes so long for it to encrypt any of my archives. So it's been something that's been a little bit of a concern, especially lately, but I am considering just kind of building my own and kind of growing it out that way. There's a guy in my office that uses FreeNAS, which is a FreeBSD-based operating system that you can install on bare metal and attach a bunch of disks to, and then create your own ZFS pools that way. Hmm. And it has a nice web interface to let you create file systems and share them out. So, you know, there's pros and cons on both sides there. Doing it yourself is going to be less expensive, but buying something like a Synology or a ReadyNAS or a Drobo gives you an awful lot for very little effort.
Yeah, and that's the thing. For me personally, for at home, I spend so much time doing stuff, you know, hardcore geek stuff at work. When I get home, I don't want to play sysadmin.
Yeah. Well, that's what, you know, we have that shared Xserve in a data center somewhere specifically because, you know, running an OpenBSD servers, over the years, I've had several OpenBSD machines that had to run OpenBSD current. So doing like kernel rebuilds and make worlds and maintaining patches and things like that was just not something I was too keen on doing anymore either. So on my time, I want to be able to click the update button and walk away.
Yep.
All right. Very cool. So and one other topic here that we don't want to address specifically here, although we did kind of touch on it, backups and recovery. We probably want to cover in a future show is what we're thinking.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for that in a future episode. But we want to talk more specifically about how to manage backups, what services are out there,
what your options are,
what methodologies you can use and that sort of stuff. But we're kind of, you know, glossing over that a bit on this show. So just a heads up there. Any final thoughts before we conclude our discussion of storage?
I think we covered it pretty well.
All right. Good. Very good. In that case, then we will sign off for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show. Thanks so much to John for joining us.
Thanks, John.
Definitely. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
You bet. And if you want to contact the Hell Yeah Show, the email is show@hellyeah.com. The web address is show.hellyeah.com. And Emery.
On the Twitter machine, you can reach us at twitter.com/hellyeahshow, also @hellyeahshow.
Indeed. All right, and that will do it for the storage episode. We will see you again next week.